You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 298. And in this one, I chat with Dr. Jason Crompinger. Jason is a clinical psychologist at the OCD Institute at McLean Hospital. And in it, we talk about his therapy story, case formulation versus diagnosis, or maybe diagnosis then case formulation is a better way of saying that. The barriers to accessing exposure and response prevention therapy, perfectionism, acceptance and commitment therapy, functional analytic psychotherapy. We discuss the role of the self and much, much more. So a wide-reaching episode, we cover many different types of therapy and how they may interact and interlink. And thank you as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that I do. And NoCD now operate in the USA, the UK, Australia and parts of Canada. So if you want to find out more about their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. Thank you as always to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Jason. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. And I always like to get people's sort of therapy story. So not necessarily your own therapy, if you've had some, but although you could if you wanted, but more, you know, why become a therapist, a clinician, and why specifically OCD?
Oh, man. Yeah, I went to grad school not thinking that I was going to be a therapist. Actually, it was very sort of research focused. And my first introduction to the acronym ERP was actually in this specific area of research called event-related potentials, event-related brain potentials. So I was doing this kind of neuroscience research. Mm-hmm. So then I did a practicum at the Center for Treatment and Study of Anxiety, just because you had to do a practicum if you went to school for clinical psychology. I was working with it's an amazing, well-known OCD expert named Marty Franklin under his supervision. And he played a significant role in just really turning me on to the power of this intervention, how life-changing it can be, kind of the role of science, the role of sort of like careful formulation, careful thought, careful sort of assessment and hypothesis testing, and how that kind of really played a significant role in helping people get well. And I saw it firsthand, and I was kind of like, I got to keep doing this. This is awesome. So I really kind of fell in love with that work. And I also just didn't realize how much I actually really enjoyed kind of hearing people's stories, but also being privy to their bravery. You know, I think that was the biggest thing that really got me very much into it. And I marvel at every day now where, you know, I'm privileged to work at this place where, you know, people come from all over the country to do this kind of intensive residential treatment here at McLean. And, you know, I just always have this kind of like thought in my head, like these people have put their lives on hold to come out here and live here. And, you know, the it's not like the cushiest environment by any stretch. And they're deliberately confronting their deepest, darkest fears every day. You grab 100 people on the street, I don't know how many people would sign up for that. You know, it's amazing. It's truly amazing. Yeah. So it's kind of what each and every day, you know, obviously there's like ups and downs to life and to this work, but I think that's the biggest thing that just kind of gets me going and keeps me sucked into it.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
So let's jump straight into it. So let's discuss case formulation versus diagnosis. Initially, what's the difference and why? What are the benefits of emphasizing case formulation?
Yeah, so, you know, diagnosis is essentially you're looking at symptoms, right? So, you know, in our field, we use this manual, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, we're in the fifth edition now, I think, DSM-5. And, you know, essentially it's got a whole bunch of diagnoses in there grouped by kind of overall theme. And each diagnosis is a collection of symptoms. And essentially what you're doing is you're assessing the presence or absence of these symptoms and, you know, kind of making a determination from there. And I think it certainly has its place. I don't want to sort of toss it aside, especially in the area of OCD, when you're sort of, you know, creating differential diagnoses between, you know, OCD and like a psychotic disorder, or OCD and more of an impulse control problem, or a personality disorder or something like that. I think that's really useful as far as kind of getting people into the right treatment. Yeah. Especially with OCD, we just know that it's so important that people get into the right treatment. I know you know this. But once I think that, you know, at a certain point though, once you're in treatment and once you're kind of in the boat of treatment planning and trying to put together, how am I going to work with this patient? Diagnosis doesn't really help you anymore. You really should shift over into case formulation. And formulation is really, what are the factors that give rise to these symptoms? Now, what are the elements? What are the variables at play that create the circumstance of these symptoms? So, you know, I think about, there's a little metaphor that's in, it's a book called The Worry Trap. I know they talk, we all know The Happiness Trap. The Worry Trap is also good. In that book, they describe this metaphor of, you know, a man. So I can get into a little bit, but there's a man who lives in a gas tank, and then there's a man who lives in a water tank. And the man who lives in the gas tank, you know, looks over and sees the man who lives in the water tank. He's enjoying a candlelit dinner, and he says, "Oh gosh, I'd like to have a candlelit dinner too." And he goes over and he says, "Can I borrow your? I don't have any candles or matches. Can I borrow some of those?" And he says, "Sure." And he brings those candles back to his gas tank, and he sets them up and he lights the match. And of course, the whole thing explodes. And the moral of the story is that context matters. So for everybody's got lit matches in their head, meaning like everybody's got intrusive thoughts, like things that pop up that are unwanted or sort of like not in fitting with how you see yourself. But for some people, there's an explosion, but for other people, there's not. And formulation is what helps you understand, well, why for that person having that thought in that circumstance is it an explosion, meaning a lot of distress, anxiety, provocation of compulsions, that kind of thing, versus somebody else who can just sort of have that thought and for whatever reason sort of shrug their shoulders at it and move on, not really pay attention to it.
Yeah, I really like that. And what comes to my mind, well, I mean, I'm a therapist myself, and I'm not a psychologist, therefore I can't diagnose officially. So I'm always doing formulation. You know, I don't really have a choice.
Absolutely.
But I like that, you know. What came to me as you were saying that is you're almost trying to figure out why this part of OCD for this person.
Yeah.
Which I think brings to mind of some people hold the view that OCD is a medical condition. It's a biological issue in the brain, and maybe there's some truth to that. But as far as I'm aware, there's no solid evidence for it.
Yeah, there's some good evidence to suggest a neural underpinning, but that doesn't really, you know,
but it's not the whole.
No question about it.
Absolutely. You know,
a biological component, it's a psychological, it's a sociological component. So yes,
very much so. Yeah. So in that case, the way you were talking and led me to think that you're trying to look for underlying causes that also need to be worked on, whether that's systematic in the family, whatever.
Absolutely. So you kind of want to know, you know, back to the example of an intrusive thought. So you're standing on a subway platform and, what do you call it there?
The underground.
And you know, again, you have the thought, I could push somebody in front of this subway platform. And again, you have two people standing side by side. One person has that thought, moves on, gets on the train. The other person is sort of paralyzed by that thought. So why is that thought more powerful for that second person? It's because, you know, for example, they have this underlying belief that thoughts are inherently much more meaningful and important than the first person does. So they believe that, you know, thoughts mean something deeply about them fundamentally as a person. They perhaps are walking around generally not sure if they're like a good person or not. Maybe that's just kind of a general struggle of theirs. And they have this intrusive thought, I want to push somebody in front of a subway. Oh, geez, I can't bear that. I can't allow that thought to exist. The fact that thought causes anxiety, perhaps they're particularly sensitive to the experience of anxiety. It's just like, I don't want to have this, just the feel, forget about the content, even just like the feeling itself, I don't want to have. These are the variables that you really need to pay attention to in order to understand how the person has arrived at the OCD, at the diagnosis of OCD, and again, what gave rise to the symptoms. Because if you don't, you know, then you're kind of just like taking a one size fits all sort of approach to treatment. Oh, you have this interest, I'm going to give you this set of exposures to do. But if the person, I think, isn't thoroughly assessed and understood, then it's going to be much more difficult to get people on board with treatment.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, music to my ears. Okay, so already sort of talking about exposure response prevention. What is, in your experience, some barriers to accessing it?
Yeah. When you asked me about barriers, I was going to talk about kind of like less the literal, like, I can't find a treater kind of a thing. That's a whole problem in and of itself. I don't mean to dismiss that. It's a whole problem, obviously, in and of itself. But I'm talking about like once they're in treatment, like, how do they actually, you know, this in doing this work, it's like, then it's a matter of bringing the person in contact with the treatment and getting them to sort of like unlock the power of it and do it in a way that works. And you know, it's a few different things. One thing that I will kind of often find is that people have conflated OCD with their values in this kind of fundamental way, where it's, you know, something to the effect of, you don't understand, I need to do this. I need to engage in these rituals because I care so much, you know, because I care about my family, because I care about my work. I can't bear to allow this uncertainty to exist because if I do, then that potentially could mean that I care about them less, or I'm just not living according to the way that I want to live. So, you know, for example, I've had folks say things like, I'll just stick with the intrusive thoughts kind of example, right? Where people have intrusive thoughts about harm and coming to their loved ones, and they do a bunch of mental rituals to get rid of them. And they have OCD, so they'll say, I know that it seems crazy that I do this, you know, it's nonsensical. But even if there's a 0.00001% chance that me doing these rituals helps, I'm going to do it, you know, because I would do anything for my family. And then it's kind of a question of helping people to take that step back and see that, you know, your rituals have, there's this narrative around your OCD that your brain has created where these rituals are moving you towards who you care about. But of course, in reality, they're not. Of course, nobody in their family is thanking them for engaging them in these rituals. You know, oh gosh, well, really, I really appreciate you protecting me and isolating yourself. Often people like that aren't even seeing their, you know, they're staying away from their family. They're not even connected to their family. So there's a lot of work I think that we need to do as therapists to create this context in which resistance of rituals I think we talked a lot about we're going to embrace uncertainty, we're going to take the risk, blah, blah. That's good. That's cool. But I think in a lot of cases, especially when this kind of value stuff gets really tangled up, you have to like frame the ritual prevention as this is an act of caring and connection with your family. You know, like this is something that to not do rituals is a step in the direction of being with your loved ones. Allowing them to quote unquote die in your heads is actually a move towards them. You know what I mean? So that's like, you're doing a lot of work to, I think, create that frame in treatment.
Yeah. I like that. As you say, you're almost letting them die figuratively in your mind. So your relationship can like literally live. Exactly. Yeah, in reality. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. I'm going to perfectionism, this kind of happens a lot where, you know, people are like, no, I'll spend hours on an academic paper or just at my job, whatever it is, you know, whatever the case might be. And it's because I care so much about what it is that I do. And again, taking that step back and saying like, oh, but God, but you're not able to finish school. Like you're not able to actually, you know, get any of your work done. And indeed, you know, you're, this might be a little bit weird to say, but I kind of will say to those people sometimes, you're a crappy perfectionist. Like you're not a good perfectionist because your life's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And it gets funky. I mean, this whole thing with perfectionism where it kind of gets funky that, you know, within the walls of the treatment setting, it's like a diagnosis. Outside of these walls, you put it on a resume, right? It's like a badge of honor. You call yourself, it gets complicated. But the perfectionism we're talking about in treatment is the kind that really is impairing. So again, seeing there's this kind of, might be this frame or this kind of connection in folks' minds where, that's consistent with who I am. I want to be a perfectionist. I want to pursue relentlessly, like the best outcomes possible. there's nothing inherently problematic about being high achieving and wanting a lot out of your life and doing really, really well. But I think in specific, you know, in the case of OCD, the way that you're navigating it isn't you're not getting it. Just look at the evidence, look around you. Mm-hmm. So again, kind of disentangling the rituals from the value, you know, and saying like, this is not, OCD doesn't care about your values. All OCD cares about is getting rid of bad feelings, basically. Mm-hmm. Like that's what it cares about fundamentally.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, just you saying that, like it can get murky then with the values and OCD, and when it gets entangled, trying to make sense of that kind of mess.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Another, just to throw out another barrier. Yeah, that's one that is that. This is one where I it's kind of like a regret thing. So there's a couple different, I'll just kind of describe it. Maybe you tell me what it sounds like to you. I don't know if I have a good word for it. I've thrown around the term emotional dissonance. But it's kind of this idea that, especially for folks who have had OCD a long time, it's not just anxiety that they're facing when they resist their rituals. So, all right, I'm gonna tell this little weird story and, maybe you cut this out, maybe not. We'll see. I don't know. I like it, but we'll go from there. I've always been, so this is about me. I've always been somebody who, or at least particularly when I was younger, my 20s, I hate traffic. Like I just hate sitting in traffic. Like, and of course, that sounds silly. Like everybody hates traffic. I really hate traffic. It's just, I get really, really annoyed whenever I'm just sitting and not moving in my car. And there was a stretch of time when I was before grad school and I was dating my girlfriend at the time, now wife, I was living in Connecticut and she was living in New Jersey. So to visit her, I don't know if you're familiar with the New Jersey Turnpike, it's this hugely just traffic, it's just traffic ridden stretch of highway. It's terrible, the worst stretch of highway potentially in the United States. So I'd be, you know, I'd see her every other weekend, I'd be driving down there and she'd drive up to see me. And then, so I fight through all this traffic to see her. And then we want to go out somewhere because when I saw her, if we hit any traffic, because I was already burnt out from the traffic I was already sitting in, if I was in any traffic, I would just be so grumpy. I'd get in this mode of like, oh my gosh, like what is happening right now? And you know, she's a normal person. She's just sort of like, whatever, this traffic, kind of like trying to joke with me, trying to like, you know, just make conversation, talk about whatever. And I'm just like super grumpy. Got like this scowl on my face, just like gripping the steering wheel. I remember one time we were sitting in traffic and I was doing my grumpy thing. I was in grumpy mode because of course that's what I do when I'm in traffic, I go into grumpy mode. And she's just like rolling her eyes. And she looks across me and to the other car, to the car next to us. And she goes, "Hey, is it okay if can I say a little curse?"
Yeah.
She looks over to the car next to us and she says, "Hey, when do you think it was the last time that guy took a shit?" And I broke, right? For that moment, I was completely unexpected and I laughed. But then I immediately buttoned back up into like angry, grumpy mode. And it was because I didn't want to be in laugh mode. If I was in laugh mode and I let myself relax and be in laugh mode while I was in traffic, then maybe I've been wrong about how I've been doing traffic all this time. Like maybe I could have been doing that all along, but I just, for whatever reason, have chosen nonsensically to just be in grumpy mode while I'm in traffic. And that doesn't sit right with me. I want to think, and people generally want to think that our behavior kind of like makes sense within us, even if to somebody else it doesn't. So bring it to OCD. When we're having people resist rituals, it's not just that they're facing this experience of the anxiety having to do with the content of their obsessions. It's like, but wait a minute, this is what I've always done. And you're telling me that I could just, or maybe I've even seen firsthand that I can not do that. I have the capacity to resist that. Oh man, like what does that mean about me? What does that mean about the past X number of years in my life? It can be very painful for people. And I think that we as therapists just need to name that. I think I've seen enough and kind of create a context where that is just another emotional experience to be allowed for, acknowledged, you know, validated, et cetera. I think if we don't, then people can sort of get this. I think what can happen is that people just kind of lock back into their rituals just because they just don't want that. You know, they just don't understand what that feeling is, or just like it just maybe feels like maybe ERP is not going to work for me because I have that feeling, or nobody ever talks about this, and maybe I'm the only one. So it can really sap people's motivation to keep going.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what was your guess for the guy in the car?
Oh, I would have said, like, he looked pretty relaxed. So I would have said right before he got in his car, and he's been in the car for about an hour or so, I would say. So he's been around.
He must have knew he was going to be stuck on that road.
Exactly.
I'm going to use that game now. Okay, so, yeah, all valuable barriers. And I think ERP can be quite a daunting therapy at times. And I think trying to acknowledge and then address those barriers, and I'm sure there are many, many more, I think is important. Definitely the one I see a lot is like not wanting to let go of the content and take that risk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is where a lot of the work is, I find.
Yeah, the uncertainty, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so my next question is, yeah, so let's talk about acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah, sure.
So you use that too. How do you use it sort of in combination with ERP or kind of by itself when working with someone with OCD?
Yeah. I think that the way that I, when I think about, you know, what ACT and ACT principles do for us as ERP therapists, I think the most important thing that it has done for an important thing that it's done is promote this idea that treatment is about developing a new relationship with these unwanted inner experiences as opposed to eliminating them. So, a problem that I've seen here at McLean with folks who get to us. So it used to be like, 10 years ago or so when I first got here, there were people that just were completely naive to any treatment. They haven't had any treatment. So they didn't really know about ERP. Maybe they had known a little bit about ERP and they'd never done ERP. And of course, we're like, okay, great, cool. Let's get into ERP. In more recent times, it's kind of people who I've done ERP and it doesn't work for me, something like that. And then of course, as your sort of radar goes up as a therapist, like, okay, so what is it about the way that they're navigating ERP that might be kind of undermining the whole process for them. Mm. And I've seen people for whom they have used, essentially in a nutshell, ERP is used as yet another way to try to control their experience, if that makes sense. There's some people who can use it sort of that way and it works totally fine. There's a subset of people who are like, stick with the intrusive thoughts example, if I have my intrusive thoughts, I need to kind of drop what I'm doing and do my exposure. I have to do my imaginal exposure script or something along those lines X amount of time, during the course of a day. And the way that they're navigating is, I need to do this sort of like, get rid of this basically, is I have to do this so I can like not have the anxiety. Of course, they're letting themselves have it. They're doing it the right way, but their intention behind it is like, I'm doing this with the idea of maybe I have this thought less, or maybe I have less anxiety about it. And for some people, that can be just a really problematic way to navigate treatment, because again, it's just like that their relationship with their anxiety and their intrusive thoughts is that these things are enemies that I have to root out and destroy. And thus, you might see the situation where maybe they make some progress with a certain set of symptoms, right? But then at some point later, they have a different set of symptoms and it's like, okay, now I've got to tackle that. It's like the whack-a-mole effect we kind of see a lot in OCD. Yeah. Now I've got to tackle that. And these other symptoms, going to have to tackle that. And it just sort of perpetuates this lifelong sort of like antagonism between themselves and their inner experiences. Where ACT has kind of helped give us this language for acceptance. Coexistence is a word I use a lot in therapy now, where it's like, we're practicing bringing in these, we're going after these experiences. We're going to allow for these experiences. We're not going to control them in any way. It's very complementary with ERP, of course. We're not going to engage in control strategies, ways to eliminate these thoughts, ways to eliminate these experiences. And we're going to make efforts to move towards what we care about amidst those experiences and kind of let your anxiety do whatever it is it's going to do and kind of let your thoughts do whatever it's going to do. So I think what's been really useful for me as far as like integrating ACT with ERP, I'm not really talking about like habituation a lot these days. I was trained on the habituation model. I think for some people it can really be useful. But especially if I get the sense that, in the formulation that they really kind of hate the anxiety and they're here to, they're looking to me to like take it away for them, then I'm not really having that conversation. I'm having more of this conversation about coexistence, acceptance, reducing ways of controlling, making efforts to, again, attend towards what you care about, move towards that, despite the narratives that are in their head about why they should do their rituals, why those rituals are important to them. So it kind of gets sort of woven in to the context of ERP in that way.
Yeah, good explanation. And, you know, since you, when you originally trained versus say now where you use more ACT in combination with ERP, yeah, or at least an ACTified way of doing ERP. Yeah. Have you lost some of the structure, if that makes sense? Because my traditional view of ERP is like we create this list of items, let's systematically tackle one at a time.
Yeah.
Is it less focus on that and more on kind of go about your life in a more ACT way?
Yeah, it totally depends. I think there are plenty of people for whom you still do this. It's kind of like you do the treatment as usual, but in this case, the treatment as usual is like traditional ERP in the way that you're talking about, where I mean, for everybody I still create a list. I don't call it hierarchy as much because I don't necessarily progress up the hierarchy in that. Again, for some people that might be useful, but I still want to know what triggers them. You know, I still want to have a sense of kind of as they're navigating their day, what they're encountering and how they're reacting to it and how much anxiety that causes and stuff like that. So I'll still provide that structure. I'll still kind of create that structure, but then it's within that structure, there's a lot of flexibility, you know, where, you know, as opposed to back in the day when it was like, all right, let's start with this exposure and let's not move on until we've habituated by half, you know? And then, you know, for some people it's like, oh my God, I'm not habituating. What do I do? You know, I'm stuck on this exposure for weeks. No, we're going to bounce around a little bit. You know, we're going to do this exposure. We'll get better at reacting to the experience. Maybe, you know, it probably does get better. It probably does, you know, habituate. It's just that that's not the goal. It's not like we're upset that when habituation happens, that's not the primary focus. But we're going to bounce around to something else. We're going to do something else. We're going to sort of vary the exposure depending on the circumstances. So it can still be, I think, structured. It's just sort of a question of, as a clinician, what you're like emphasizing with the patient. And again, the fact that I always say this, and this is not an original thought for me. Other people did this too, that the antidote to OCD is flexibility. Like that's the anti OCD is all about rigid rules. I think it's going to be problematic about our approach as clinicians. If we're too dogmatic about how we're doing therapy, we're just providing a new set of rules for people. And in that, again, for a lot of people that might not be useful. So we need to be flexible too. And again, I think ACT, we can create that structure, but ACT allows us that kind of room to say, okay, well, you know, we're just going to evaluate. We're going to observe what your experience is during these particular set of exposures. We'll move on to these other ones, you know, depending on the circumstances, but we won't kind of, we'll say nimble is I think the word that I like to use.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. So let's talk about FAP, functional analytic psychotherapy. Yes. So obviously your colleague Nate came on and we did a whole episode on FAP, and I'll link that in the show notes for anyone interested, but for those that haven't heard it, if you could briefly describe roughly what FAP is and then why it may be useful for people with OCD.
I'll give you kind of like my, I don't know if it's kind of a textbook definition this is, but I'll give you the way kind of I think about it. Functional analytic psychotherapy. It's predicated on this idea that what the patient is exhibiting in the session is relevant to their problems, basically. Anything that brought them into therapy is certainly showing up in the context of that room between you, you know, the clinician and the patient. So you're seeing, you know, FAP has a whole language around clinically relevant behaviors, CRBs is what they call them. So you have a patient who exhibits, for example, a lot of, in the OCD, it might be a lot of people pleasing type of behavior, a lot of excessive friendliness and sort of a complimentary, you know, nature, that sort of thing. That might be very much clinically relevant as if that's what kind of brought them into the room. It doesn't have to be just stuff like that, though. It could be you could see that when a person is pushed, when a hard limit is set on a certain behavior, that a person exhibits a particular set of responses that they, you know, perhaps react angrily, or perhaps they react with a withdrawn response, or perhaps they react with a whole set of rationale as to why, you know, their behavior kind of makes sense. It focuses on the extent to which a clinician's responses to those behaviors shapes those behaviors, which I think is super, super important. So, you know, if somebody is responding in a way that is very compatible with, or let's say, agreeable and sort of compliant with what it is that I'm pushing them to do in treatment. I might feel as a clinician like, oh, good. Like that makes me happy that they're doing what I'm asking them to do. But it may be the case that that kind of behavior is kind of what got them here in the first place, where like excessive compliance and the function of that compliance being more about making sure that nobody's mad at them versus the function of the compliance being about them. And like, you know, I want to work on this for myself and kind of get better. If I don't pay attention to how that's occurring in the session, then I'm inadvertently reinforcing, again, an issue that's problematic for this person. So FAP, I think, shines the spotlight on that interaction. And it, for me personally, it helps me to be very, very mindful of just literally how I'm talking to somebody in a session and how I'm coming across. I think about like, I was mentioning before how often these days patients come here more familiar with ERP, like with treatment. And I think about how I've seen this, there's a subset of patients who they come and it's almost like they already know in their heads everything they're going to hear. They know what an ERP therapist is going to say to them. They know about hierarchies, know what they're going to tell them not to be doing anymore, you know, and stuff like that. And again, they've already sort of like assembled this response to it. It's sort of like they go into this mode of I'm in this patient role. The clinician is going to be in their clinical role, their clinician, ERP clinician role, and we're going to have this back and forth. And it's not going to actually be terribly productive. It's going to be, maybe it'll be kind of a battle, or again, maybe it'll be sort of like on the surface, like a healthy, productive, like a good therapeutic relationship or a productive relationship at least. But, you know, again, the person isn't really making the changes for the right reasons. When I think about that, I think about, all right, how do I need to present myself to the patient to sort of undermine that a little bit? I want to ensure that when the patient comes in, those expectations are sort of violated a little bit, where instead you're not getting a ERP robot in me. Like robots will never, like the cool thing about our jobs is that robots will not replace us. Maybe everybody else, but not us. I just fundamentally believe that. Okay. So they're not going to get that from me. They're going to get, somebody who I try to just be as genuine as I possibly can and come across like, I'm not really interested in fitting you into this treatment or like, you know, staying in my role as ERP therapist and thus in reinforcing this you staying in this role as patient. I'm interested in just understanding you as a human being and understanding how I might be helpful. And, you know, having that sort of a more genuine approach and working on that understanding and connection with a patient is, I think, setting a stage for a much more productive therapeutic relationship than adhering to these roles. So again, I think FAP helps us to sort of pay attention to those kinds of variables that if you're too focused on a technique, you don't really think about that, those interpersonal factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was always one of my criticisms of ERP is it's for when it's effective, it's very effective.
Yeah.
But there's this whole external piece that it's not tackling and it's not targeting the other areas of people's lives that also cause them pain and probably influence the OCD in some way too, you know, because the way I look at it, everything is linked in our mind. You know, there's no neat diagnostic box in the brain. There's millions of neurons kind of going off at different and same times. And
there's so many, totally. I mean, you know, no behavior or an OCD, it's not interpretable out of context, you know, and like you're saying, everything's linked, that's the context. So including, you know, this context, this therapeutic context is very much, I'm gesturing over here we talked about, you know, to my like chair where I sit in when I meet with people, that's what I'm pointing to over here. But, you know, the therapeutic context is certainly influencing, like you say, influencing their OCD, influencing to what extent they hang on to their OCD, engage in their compulsions. And then, of course, then influencing to the extent to which they engage in treatment. Incredibly important to pay attention to. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, thank you for going into that. We kind of answered that one. Let's talk about the role of the self and how that plays into the treatment. Yeah. So I guess also, what is the self?
Oh, I don't know. What is the self? I know the self is... that's the thing. I think that the self is ill-defined, right? Like or maybe not ill-defined, maybe over-defined or variously defined. Yeah. There's a billion different ways to look at what a self is, right? Some people, there's this, I do this talk and I show this clip. If anybody's familiar with this, it's a scene from this really bad Adam Sandler movie called Anger Management with Jack Nicholson. Do you know it?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And there's a scene where he's at this support group and he's like, tell me about yourself to Adam Sandler. And he says like, oh, well, I work at this, blah, blah. He's like, well, no, don't tell me about your job. Tell me about yourself. And he's like, I guess I'm a good guy and all that. Well, don't tell me about your personality. Tell me about yourself. And it's this whole like frustrating back and forth. So I don't know what a self is, but everybody's got a different definition of it. And a useful thing I think about in the context of treating OCD is that, and this is, again, ACT gives us some language around self, where there's an idea of an autobiographical self. And then there's this kind of self as context. So autobiographical self, you know, thought of as sort of like my self narrative. So who am I? Like I'll talk about me. Like I am a clinical psychologist. I'm a husband and a father. I am a brother. I am mostly Italian. You know, I don't have an Italian last name. I enjoy running and video games and sports and, you know, that sort of thing. Like all those things sort of like are the autobiography, right? I mean, I could talk about my other interests, whatever it is, the autobiography of me. And that's great. That's fine. But if people are too fixed on that, like they're too tightly connected to this is me fundamentally, then that could be a tenuous situation, because what happens if one of those variables changes somehow? So, you know, what happens if somebody who sees themselves as a firefighter, and that they've been a firefighter their whole life, and that is crucial, woven into the fabric of their identity, they lose their leg and they're not able to be a firefighter anymore, just to get as an example. Obviously, it's a terrible situation, and anybody that would be just a lot of suffering. But are they less of a self? Are they less of a person? You know, to themselves, like that is a, I think that's a whole different type of suffering. You know, if the person is very connected to this idea of what they are. So, I like to play around with this idea that maybe there are other ways of viewing what a self actually is. And self as context is this, just in a nutshell, to me, is this idea that, you know, you, I mean, certainly you have thoughts, certainly you have things that you care about, things that you value, you got inner experiences, emotions, memories, images, all that sort of stuff. But that's, none of it's you. You are the container of all that. The kind of cheesy metaphor, but I really like it, is like, you know, your thoughts are the birds, your memories of the stars, you know, your behaviors are the clouds. And you are the sky, you know. You are what contains all that. And that's kind of like indestructible, you know. Kind of like that can't be. So that's not tenuous in sort of any way. So I think sometimes with OCD, getting back to what I was saying before about, you know, when people are resisting rituals, they might feel like, well, that's not me to resist rituals. If we kind of intervene around that and say, well, what is you exactly? You know, could it be? Are you just these behaviors? Are you your OCD? You know. Are you how you navigate the world? Can we be flexible about how we define you? I think that can create a context where people are a little bit more, you know, willing to have these different experiences. You know, we say things like, you know, I'm not somebody who would ever skydive. Well, you can say that, but you could still skydive. You can still, if you like tomorrow, like just go do that. You know, these rules, like we will typecast ourselves with the autobiographical stuff. And you know, for some people that might work totally great. Cool. If it works for them, they're happy. Honestly, like I want them to get it there. And I'm sure you, for me, there's some autobiographical stuff that I think is really useful. But again, if it's sort of like this and I need it, and if I don't have that, then I'm fundamentally broken, lost, selfless. Then again, that having some flexibility around self concepts can be useful.
I like that. Yeah. It's much more having those conversations, you're also really helping them shape and figure out who they are, you know. Yeah. Because I think a lot through the podcast, a lot of the stuff that's come out over the years is, you know, I've been doing so many compulsions and for so many hours a day that don't know who I am or what I like, or absolutely. And that conversation could kind of start that.
Totally. Completely.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. So You're the director of the training program at OCDI. Is that still the case?
Yeah.
Cool. What are some of the common areas of OCD treatment that students either sort of misunderstand or take longer to comprehend? Or
I love that question.
One thing that's so a couple of things. One thing that comes to mind is it's fundamentally important as a clinician to recognize your own emotional experiences in the context of this work. Mm-hmm. So I'm a CBT therapist, ACT therapist through and through. So I might burst into flames by saying that, psychodynamic has given, interventions have given us some useful language around this. They might call it countertransference or, you know, any of those kinds of things. But really, I'm just talking about, you know, the emotional reactions to the patients, to the work that they're doing. I think oftentimes as trainees, like a stumbling block is making a decision in treatment that's essentially more based on kind of the person's own anxiety rather than what actually might be useful to the patient, especially in the context of ERP treatment, where what you'll see is that so ERP works. I believe that through and through. When people do it, it works. A bunch of people don't do it. And that's the, again, that's the issue. We need to like address like all the people that for a whole number, a host of reasons, have a hard time actually accessing treatment. But because ERP is so effective, you can see in the field, a lot of people will be very vocal and dogmatic about ERP. And if like you're, it's like you're doing malpractice if you're not doing ERP and sort of doing it in this particular way. And be very opinionated and very sort of strong-willed about it. And even training settings, it can be sort of like, that's kind of, to some extent, was my experience in training, was like, if you're not sort of following the manual, literally the manual in the way that it's presented, then you're sort of, you're doing things wrong. And what can happen there then is that trainees kind of get more attached to, okay, I at least have to be saying the right things, even if, again, what the patient is doing isn't sort of matching up with what they're saying or isn't terribly useful. So I'm going to proceed forward with an exposure, even though I don't know that this person really is connected to the idea of exposure, or even though I can sort of see, or maybe they can't see, but just the person doesn't understand why it is that this exposure is kind of taking place, or just they don't agree, their relationship with their anxiety is not really being addressed here. They've missed sort of like the patients in this kind of boat where they feel as though they're misunderstood by the clinician, and the clinician is just sort of proceeding, you know, again, just because, well, I need to adhere to these guidelines, I need to adhere to this manual. And the reason why the clinician is doing that, sort of insensitive to the context of working with a patient, is because they're anxious. Like, I want to just do the right thing. I want to say the right things in treatment. I want to present the right intervention. And again, I'm not going to sort of actually respond to the person. They don't have that sort of flexibility to see that, okay, there are some cases where you need to, like, proceeding forward with ERP is not going to be useful because they're not getting what they need to get. They're not on board. You know, they're not sort of approaching it in the way that is going to be productive for them. And it becomes more, you know, unfortunately, it becomes more about, you know, them sort of covering their own butts rather than actually doing the work. But even just stuff like, also, you know, in the context of doing a specific exposure, you can have students say things like, I didn't want the person to have a panic attack. Well, why? You know, I mean, like, are we afraid of anxiety or are we not? I don't mean to be flipping about panic attacks, but, our job, the work that we're trying to do here is to help the patient develop this new relationship with their anxiety, where it's not this terrifying beast that needs to be sort of controlled or avoided. It's not like, well, this amount of anxiety is okay, but this isn't. Whatever your experience is what it's going to be. And to be able to sit with somebody and model for them an accepting stance towards their anxiety, including panic attacks, I think is really, really important. But very, very, none of this isn't meant to be a criticism of training. This is just a learning, like kind of a learning edge for them. You know what I mean? Like, this is a point of training, where to be able to sit with somebody, literally sit with somebody who's having a panic attack, is a harder skill than it may sound. So that's I think a big barrier for a lot of folks that are doing this training. It also relates to, I mean, some of this just is kind of my the second thing I was going to just mention was it's kind of that self stuff again, where I think trainees have like a certain set of rules in their head for how they are supposed to be. Like, you know, they have to present. I find that sometimes trainees will feel the need to present themselves here, at least, as like finished products already. Like, all right, I've read this stuff. So much of the information about ERP is out there, right? Like, you can read plenty of books, you can read papers, you can get on the IOCDF, you know, webpage and all that sort of stuff, and kind of get really educated about what is it that you're gonna that you're doing. So even before coming into doing trainings here, that people have sort of a head start, and there's this need to like, I have to play this role of like finished product. Like, I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm the expert. And I see that, but not just in training, just people who are kind of seasoned clinicians, that they're working with patients and they get so stuck on this idea that I need to never not have an answer. You know what I mean? Like, I have to be able to get everything that's showing up. You know, when a patient, I think the worst version of that is when a patient says like, you couldn't possibly understand what it is that I'm going through. And a clinician will have some, I don't know if you've heard this kind of response, but it's sort of like a cancer doctor doesn't need to have cancer to be able to work with that cancer. It's a stupid thing to say. The right answer to me is like, no, you're right. I don't. If you don't, you know, it's like, no, I don't know what it's like, you know, and that's the right answer. That's the way to actually be genuine and make a connection with people. Maybe you drop that whole, like, I'm an expert, I know everything thing, but be willing to drop that. You know what I mean? It's in the service of making that connection, understanding the patient. So I think that over-identification, getting back to self stuff a little bit, like over-identification with this role that you have to play and being inflexible around that is an issue too.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm not sure why I asked the question, but I think your first point about the rigidity of like having to follow ERP and CBT protocols and manuals. And I think it goes the other way. So, you know, I've been at a training institution before where they were like, almost if you veer off that protocol, you'll almost be hung, drawn and quartered. You know, it was a horrible learning experience for me. You know, it temporarily made me hate CBT, you know. And then the other point was, kind of what you're saying about the cancer doctor analogy. What comes to my mind is just always being human in the room and putting that before any treatments. Absolutely. You know, and that reminds me of Cole Rogers and humanistic counseling, and that still needs to be remembered because that's still the relationship, you know, the core conditions. Yep. And always for me that comes before everything else, and then I stack everything on top of that.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think you can go anywhere without that. If a person is sitting with you and they think that you are seeing them as just a walking ball of OCD, you know, and not fundamentally a person, then it's just not, you know, to me, it's just not gonna work in the way that is actually useful to that person, you know, in a way that promotes long-term recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Jason. What'd you tell him?
Oh, man. I think what I was doing when I was 20. Oh, man. Just about anything or about like...
Anything you want.
Oh, man, what do I tell him?
What would he need to know?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I love that question so much. I think I'd say to him, you know, just relax. You know, like... Not like in it's all going to be okay way, because it's not, you know, obviously, but it's like all the stuff you're doing, you know, to try to make sure it's okay, toss those aside a little bit, you know what I mean? Like, just live your life, just be there, just, you know, be connected to those around you and worry less about like, having to, again, I don't mean this to like necessarily fit so perfectly with what we've already talked about, but just like, don't like worry about trying to cram yourself into a certain mold, and just like, however you are is okay. You know, just go with that at least and see how that works. You know, see how it works when you just sort of like relax those rules you have for yourself a little bit and just go with it. Maybe it'll crash and burn, but probably not. So something like that, I think.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. And then probably equally as hard question, you've got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Oh, man. Yeah. That might be a little easier. Where's the billboard?
Anywhere you want.
Anybody, you're saying like general, like anybody can see it.
Yeah. Let's say,
New Jersey Turnpike.
That's going to say,
Something like anxiety is okay. Something like that, honestly. And I think a major problem that we have as a society, at least in Western society, is that anxiety is seen as, like, getting back to diagnosis and all that, like a symptom. Like, your intrusive thought is actually not a symptom. Like, your relationship to that thought and what unfolds after that and kind of the overall effect. But again, the thoughts themselves, as we've said, I'm sure you've talked this a million times in a million podcasts, just like everybody's walking around with these thoughts. Everybody's walking around with anxiety. I think we have to pathologize it less as a society. And that comes to clinicians too. Again, back to this whole idea, why I love that we've moved away from the habituation focus, not just because that's what the literature has sort of shown, the research has shown that habituation isn't terribly a good predictor of outcome, but just this idea that, no, you're not coming to treatment to like expunge your anxiety. You know, of course we want people, now I don't want to get too, our heads up our butts, like anxiety, we want people to feel better. Like, obviously we want people to be more functional. But, you know, we don't have to treat anxiety like it's this intruder to root out again and extract. And I think if on a societal level that gets promoted more and more, I think that can really alleviate some suffering, you know, so I would hope so. It's the most painful thing to me in working with, for me personally, and working with a lot of folks with OCD, is that that's kind of self-stigma, like just, so, oh, I'm so weird that I have these thoughts. I'm so broken and messed up because I have these thoughts. And you just want everybody, I just think of all the people that we don't see, right, that aren't in treatment, they don't listen to this podcast, that don't get this information, they just think that they're messed up, you know, and who knows what happens to them. So that's just really painful. So again, this idea that your inner experiences, not just anxiety, like your inner experiences are okay to have fundamentally. All thoughts and feelings are acceptable. Something like that.
Yeah, I like that. Absolutely. John Abramowitz said on the show that anxiety is safe and you can tolerate it.
Cool. Yes. There you go. Yeah. It's not.
I agree with you completely. Is there anything else you wish you could have shared today?
I think it's just a message for clinicians. And, you know, don't be hypocrites. Like, be willing to take a risk. Be willing to do the work to ensure that your patient is understood fundamentally, including when they're rejecting treatment. So you as a clinician, if somebody is resistant, let's just say resistant to treatment, quote unquote, treatment resistant, in other words, just not willing to do ERP or resist rituals in the way that you would want, quote unquote, want them to. What you need to do is this is sort of like a philosophical thing. It's a classic philosophical kind of thought, but you need to be able to restate for them precisely why it is that they're unwilling to do treatment in a way that is even better than how they would put it, where they hear you say that and say, yeah, that's, I couldn't put it better myself. That's exactly why. But it's because X, Y, and Z. They need to feel understood. So don't just, when you meet with that resistance, don't just immediately go and say, well, here's the rationale for ERP. This is why it works. We can't be like primary care doctors. So this is kind of a rant. Hopefully this makes sense. Primary care doctors kind of have this job where they have a bunch of treatments that work, right? It's like, oh, you're overweight. You need to like change your diet. Like, you need to exercise more. You need to stop smoking. All that stuff works incontrovertibly. Like, it's all good. But, and they can present those recommendations. And then it's kind of like the patient takes it or leaves it, right? Sort of like, and that's where their job sort of ends. Like, well, I told the patient, I documented this patient needs to change his diet, all sort of stuff. And I don't mean to dismiss primary care doctors, but you know, that's what they do. I don't think we should be functioning like that, where it's like, well, here's ERP, it works. You know, I told them they need to face these particular set of sessions. They need to resist these rituals. This is how they're supposed to do it. Kind of take it or leave it. You know, as therapists, as psychologists, as mental health professionals, our job is to actually, if people aren't willing to engage, to create a context where people engage. And perhaps a way to do that then is to not just immediately go into all the reasons why they need to do it, and more just sit with that, that resistance, you know, just hang out with that a little bit and be okay with it and just say, look, I understand, kind of, I get it. And I think that that can feel risky to clinicians for a lot of reasons. Can feel like, oh gosh, I'm not doing my job. You know, if I'm meeting with somebody with OCD and they're not ERP, I should kick them out of treatment. You know, I should fire them, quote unquote, fire them, which doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, we don't fire people, like we get fired. But I don't know. I think that that mentality has, for some people, it could be useful to sort of have that firm boundary set. For other people, it really creates a lot of hopelessness, I think, where, you know, people don't, here's this treatment that I just can't do. And people are saying, well, come back when you're ready. It's like, well, I don't know if I'll ever quite be ready to do it. So for clinicians to be willing to work with that resistance and again, focus on that mutual understanding of between the patient and therapist, I think is really important.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, sometimes some of my clients, I don't feel it's right, or they say something which is semi-treatment resistant of they're not ready, or I feel then if I just talk about ERP, that they're just, their eyes glaze over, and it's so I sit with it a bit and I work with other things, and there is part of me that comes up and feels like a failure that I'm not doing my job,
exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
But maybe those other things need to be addressed first. And
I would wager that, yeah, but hey, maybe you're not doing your job. I get ERP,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's
who
true.
Knows? Maybe you're not doing your job. Maybe you're going to get, you know, you'll get your license taken away, whatever. But I don't know. I think that we think about that 50% of people that, you know, that don't do ERP. Well, we have a lot of work to do there, and we need to be, some of us need to be willing to take some risks to say, okay, well, like you say, like, let's work on that other stuff. Let's sit with that resistance, let's explore it a little bit. And again, if nothing else, create a context where at least this person gets that I get it. And I think that is, if you've done that kind of work, you're much more likely to have somebody ultimately do the treatment, you know, compared to if they don't think you get it, then they're really not. I think you've really shut them out in that case.
That's true. Yeah, good way to end. Well, thank you so much, Jason, for sharing your wisdom. And I've really enjoyed chatting about all these topics.
Me too. I really, really enjoyed it. Really appreciate you inviting me. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.